Hello, this is Melissa. It is December 25, 2025. I hope you're all doing well. I am actually recording this late in the evening on Christmas Eve. And so I'm just saying that because I'm about to tell you about yesterday. Yesterday was the 23rd of December, and I was working in my office and doing some kind of mindless work of filing, sorting, moving things around. And whenever I have to do that kind of task, I find a talk of Alan's and I listen to it. And yesterday was no exception, except I was thinking about what I might bring you for Christmas. And on Sunday, I actually played a Christmas talk of Alan's that was excellent from 2007. And that included his guitar piece, Campeones para Siempre, which is Champions Forever. And so since I just gave you a full Christmas talk, I thought I would do something different. And I had the tape mix, different music in mind. And so the first thing that I did while I was working was I just played different Christmas music, different music that I listened to with Alan, or the kind of music that I would have listened to with Alan at Christmas, around this time of the year. He liked inspiring things that were a little bit out of the ordinary, and he liked a certain kind of Christmas music. So I found a nice compilation of Russian Orthodox Christmas carols. I found Pavarotti, of course, singing O Holy Night. That was a favorite of Alan's. And once I had the music lined up, like these are good songs, okay, I'll go with that. Then I went back and started finding little selections of Alan's talks. And when I did a keyword search for when he mentioned Russian Orthodox Christmas, one of the places in which he did that was with an interview that he had with Neil Foster in 2014, May 15. And I found about 3 minutes there where he was discussing that with Neil. And then I went on to the next song and then looking for the next little clip that I might want to put with that. And I just made a note here, human striving to become complete human beings. So a human, maybe that's the point, maybe that's the purpose, to become completely human. Then I found another talk of his along that vein. What is it to be human? How does the supernatural factor into that? And Alan talked about this on and off over the years, but he really got into it a little more deeply in 2020. So I was listening to part of a blurb from September 6. I have used various parts of this as redux over the years. And Mike in Canada used part of this for his excerpt series on evil. So day before yesterday, I was working on a project having to do with the C.S. Lewis book that I've been covering with Nick Hayes, That Hideous Strength. And it sent me down a little avenue there regarding Julian Huxley and his grandfather Thomas Huxley, and Alan Watt would point out from time to time that Julian Huxley was all about knocking humanity off its pedestal. There's nothing special about us. We are an animal. We are animals. We're in the animal kingdom, and therefore we have no more rights than an animal. And in this talk, Alan was saying it's the supernatural that gives humans rights. And there's no morality in humanism. And the project that I was working on had to do with Thomas Huxley's speech at Oxford in 1893 about ethics and evolution. And 50 years later, Julian Huxley delivered another speech on the same topic. And you get a lot of, you know, the human animal and how we have to come up with ethics, and it's a they need to be universal and trial and error, but we can do it because, you know, we're evolving. And it was kind of ridiculous and annoying, but I persevered. So I think the reason I gravitated towards this yesterday when looking through Alan's work is that there was just something, I don't know, this isn't, you know, this isn't a big word, but there's something yucky about listening to people like Julian Huxley try to knock us off our pedestal. What does it mean to have rights that are given to us by God? And it's just such a powerful, I mean, I think it's more than 4 hours. It could be pushing 5-hour talk from Alan. But if you want to spread that out over a little, you know, a week or a few days, it's well worth hearing. But when I got done listening to it, I thought, wow, you'd really put that up on Christmas. That's dark. This is getting dark. But I think this has been where my own head is at. What's going on in the world? You know, in the world that we're given to look at and be concerned with. We have this horror show in the Middle East, this absolute horror show, which is genocide of the Palestinians. That is what it is. Where whatever side you come down on, whatever you think is going on, Palestinians and Palestinian children are being killed. And this just goes on. It goes on. And you have this so-called, you know, war between Russia and Ukraine, which really just, it doesn't really have anything to do with much of what they tell us it has to do with. It's a war being prosecuted, it would appear, by the CIA for reasons that don't have anything to do with Ukraine having its territory stepped on by Russia. So that's the world, and the world is a pretty dark and evil place. That doesn't mean that there's not beautiful things in the world, that nature is not pretty, that it's not nice to go out and walk in nature. Yes, all of that is there. But this world is evil. And so, yeah, I did. I went dark. And one thing that I was thinking about yesterday, too, was who loves Christmas, you know, who really loves it with like all their heart, and they're into it, and they just do for it. And my Aunt Betty, she loves Christmas, and she's 96 years old. And that's, you know, so if I'm reflecting on what my year was about this last year, then the first several months of it, really from late January until the end of May, I was working almost full time helping my Aunt Betty get her house organized and get some things sold. And ultimately, she decided she was going to stay there for as long as she could. And that's where she still is. So God bless her that she's still able to do that. But I really gave it a lot of my time this year. And I actually also, once you know, we'd had the garage sales and done that work, I carried on a stall for her at the antique mall from May until the end of October. So like I say, this was a big part of my year, was helping her. And I'm glad that I was able to do that. I am. And I still got some other things accomplished. And I did look at it, though, and say, you know, oh, I wish I would have gotten more done this year. And so for me, it's kind of looking at the passage of time, how quickly it goes by. And, you know, I'm mortal. I'm a human. And that means that there is an end of me at some point. And I have so much, particularly on behalf of Alan's work, that I still want to accomplish. So sort of reviewing the year, how did I spend my time? Did I spend it well? Was I helpful to people? Was anything that I said or did or wrote or put out, was it useful to people? What did it open up part of their mind and let you see something differently? And was I just a decent human being? I think these things are worth reflecting on at this time of the year. And on the bright side, the days are now getting longer. And I always can feel it instantly at the solstice. I can feel that kind of hopefulness of spring coming. We're in the dead of winter, but the days are getting longer, and so I know I'm shifting there with them, and I'm looking ahead, and I'm renewing, and that's that soul-searching place where I, you know, just as I explained, how did I spend my time? Did I spend it wisely? What did I give people? So who loves Christmas? My Aunt Betty. So last night, I checked in with her in the evening, actually, and she wanted a couple more things, something for her son and something for her grandson, and did I mind? And I was out, you know, I was calling her while I was out. I said, okay, I would stop and get what she wanted to put in their stocking to complete their gift. And then she said, can you help me tomorrow? And I said, today, Christmas Eve. I said, yeah, what do you need? Well, can you come over? Can you carve the turkey? The daughter of a friend of hers. All Betty's friends are gone now. And, you know, I'm sure that weighs on her mind at this time of the year. All her friends, her siblings, they're gone. And the daughter of one of her longtime friends going way, way back to childhood, that daughter makes sure that every Thanksgiving she sends her a big box of fresh oranges, and every Christmas she sends her a smoked turkey. And it's very nice, really very nice of her to do that, I think. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll be happy to come over and carve a turkey. Well, so I'm the daughter that Betty didn't get. So, you know, when the turkey was carved and I found a nice platter to put it on, and then she was making a salad, and I said, oh, don't use that bowl, use this bowl, that's pretty. See how pretty they are together. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for finding that. Oh, I forgot. Can you put some snacks out, you know, like you did last week? Can you put some snacks out for us? So I dig around, and she bought some pimento cheese spread. That's a big thing in Texas, and found the crackers and chips, and, you know, just put that out. And by the time it was all said and done, I was over there about 2.5-3 hours. And her grandson and his wife and the great-grandson, the great-grandchildren were late. And, you know, and they're young boys, and I get it. But, you know, Betty was so excited about this. And she had in this little area, she had a tiny little Christmas tree and some candles around it. And in another area, she had all the snowmen out. And on the wall, she had a wreath. And over there, she had a little tiny tree and all the presents were there. And she had gotten me to take her to Walmart a couple of weeks ago. And it was kind of one of those things where one of my brothers said, "I'll take you there." And she said, no, I don't want you to. And so then she was in the car with my other brother and me, and she said, "Oh, if you don't mind taking me to Walmart." And so my younger brother said to me, as she was getting out of the car, she was out of earshot, and he said, "Well, what was wrong with him taking her to Walmart? You know, why did she shoot that down?" And I said, "Well, hey, she didn't want to go to Walmart with just anybody. She wanted me to go with her. She wanted me to pick out the gifts for the great-grandsons." And of course, that's what it was. And I was quick about it, you know. Yeah, but I knew exactly she was going to get them something, you know. In her mind, they'll always be babies, and they're not anymore. I think one of them is 7 or 8 now, and the other one is close to 10. And I'm like, "Oh, you know, no, not that, really." I said, "See, that's for like a 4-year-old. And I said, this remote control truck, this is what they want. They want remote control." And so anyway, she was a little flipped out because they were late getting there. And I thought, this is what we think about when we think about, you know, traditions that mean so much to people. And yet her grandson and his wife and the children, they have no idea how much time and thought and worry and concern has gone into my Aunt Betty putting this spread out and getting just the right gift and fussing over it. So I checked in with her a little bit later this afternoon. I actually stopped back by because she said, "Oh, Jamie, that's her grandson's wife. She gave me the most beautiful basket. Every year she gives me the most beautiful basket full of good food and good things, and I want you to see it." So I said, "Oh, definitely, I'll come over and look at that." And I did. And it was a nice basket. And I said, "Betty, how was Christmas? Did they like their toys?" And she said, "It was the best Christmas ever. It was just the best Christmas ever. The boys had so much fun. They loved their cars." They loved trucks or, you know, whatever. I think one was a Jeep and one was something else. But anyway, they loved them. And she said, "It just made me so happy." And I said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad it was good." And then as we were walking out the door, oh, I tasted some of her corn pudding. Now, here's the other part of the story. She was munching on a couple of French fries in a fast food box. And the corn pudding that she had made this morning while I was there doing other things and helping her, it was untouched. And so the spoon was there, and I just reached in and got a big, huge spoonful and put it in a bowl. And, you know, I said, "Wow, this is really good. They didn't touch it." And she said, "I know, I was just about to have some." And I said, "Well, did, you know, no, they brought chicken nuggets and French fries, and that's what the boys ate." In other words, they brought their own food, and that's okay. Like I said, the boys are 7 and 9 years old, so of course they want chicken nuggets and French fries, and that's what they got. It's expectations and the stress and the worry over it. But it's also, how do we interact with each other, you know? If I had my druthers, you know, I'd probably always be curled up doing my own thing. I think that's what it is to be human, is that sometimes we push ourselves a little bit harder, especially at a time of the year where tradition dictates that we do that. So as Betty was walking me out to the door the second trip over there this afternoon, she said, "Oh, I was hurting so much." She said, when they left and I put the garage door down, I was in so much pain, I just started crying. And I said, oh, no. She said, well, I went and I took a, you know, Tylenol or whatever, and then I had a little lie down and I felt better. But part of that, I'm sure, was the emotion, you know, that she's built this up for weeks. She's, wanted to see those great-grandsons, or the babies, as she calls them. So I don't want to go on too long here. I just wanted to mention something else about Christmas. Who loved Christmas? Siv Tove from Norway, who lived in England for many years. And at the end of 2023, late December before Christmas, I did a real history with her, and I entitled it Norwegian Christmas. And that's what she wanted to do the real history about. She wanted to talk about the traditions of Norway and how much she had been into Christmas when she was young. And she carried all of those traditions with her and baked the things and made the mulled wine and the salted lamb and all the homemade decorations. So the day that we were set to record, she said, I want to tell you something, but I don't want to talk about this on the real history. And I said, okay. And she said, I'm dying. I have cancer and I don't have long to live, weeks at most. And I started crying. You know, Siv Tove was younger than I, she was young, younger than I am, or was at the time. And she said, oh, please don't cry. Don't cry. I want this to be a happy Christmas real history. And I said, okay. She said, I love Christmas. I love picking out the music for it. I love the parties. I love it. So I said, okay. So I'll link again, and you can see Siv Tove's Norwegian Christmas. And she passed away probably 10 days after Christmas, I think. So it's a time of year, I think, that is meant for reflection. I think it's meant for looking back, seeing what is important to us, where we have not done our best, where we could do better, where we could be more human. And for me, part of being human is to see evil straight up for what it is. And when I can do that, when I can see things as they are without blinders of conditioning on me, there is something else that comes along with that, and that is the appreciation and the wonder and even amazement. And one of the things that fills me with wonder and amazement is all of you, because you are wonderful human people that are full of love, and you triumph against obstacles. And every day I see you. This is one of the things for my new year, as I pushed so hard this year on so many different things, and I fell very far behind on communicating. I owe so many of you phone calls and letters and emails and responses. So this is an opportunity for me to say how much I appreciate hearing from you. I appreciate that you're there. I appreciate that you love to listen to Alan's talks, that some of you listen to mine, that you're there, that you are real human beings, suffering, loving, triumphing over your own evil or the evil that comes into your life, and you're able to see the good too. And I think it is that when you, it's that full on seeing what is. But that's the best, that's the better part of every day for me, is looking at a photograph. I know whose child that is. I know where that, I can look behind me at my desk right now and see cards from some of you, or bookmarks, or you go downstairs in the kitchen and eat a cookie that somebody sent me. It's this, you know, it's love. That's what it is. So yes, this Redux has got a lot of dark. I went dark. But it also has love. I'm going to give you one of Alan's songs for this Redux called Journey in the Land of Nod. And it's one of the lighter compositions that Alan did and played on his guitar. And it feels, for me, as always when he's playing, like there's a couple of sets of hands at least. But the syncopation is just so magical. And then I'm going to end this Redux. Jose Feliciano was born blind, Puerto Rican American. And he played the guitar, and he wrote a song back in the 70s, a Christmas song called Feliz Navidad. And I'm sure many of you have heard that song. And that's not what I'm ending with. I am ending with a Jose Feliciano song, though. Alan really liked him because he was born blind, and yet he was full of love and passion and humanity. And I read something from him yesterday when I was looking at his music, and he said, I don't mind not having sight because it doesn't have anything to do with my music. And, wow. So the song I chose, I'd never heard before until yesterday. So I did not listen to this with Alan, but I would have loved to. It is a beautiful, beautiful song. And for me, the reason for the season. So you take care wherever you are, and I will be back with something soon and in I don't know what they call it, but whatever, I'll be there. I'll be ready for the new year and the longer days. Take care. And Merry Christmas. Sorry, Merry Christmas. God bless you, and Merry Christmas.
And as you know, there's houses all over Bulgaria. Like, just walk away and leave them vacant, because there's no way they can earn money to live, and so they're moving out, of course. Which again, I think is part of the agenda as well. It's deliberate.
Yeah. They're certainly killing the villages. I know we're getting off topic, but they're certainly killing the villages there. By just that methodology, the young people are leaving on mass, really. And,
yeah.
I would say. Your average village has probably got about 25-30% of the homes empty.
That's right, all over the country, yeah.
Yeah, and there's even whole villages empty.
Yes.
anybody wants to know what Agenda 21 looks like and what's coming to a town near you soon, you know, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's going. And I hear a lot of young people over there who actually, they're quite clued up.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite aware of what's going on, because they still have generations in their family who can warn them what it looks like.
That's one thing that has stuck through. We forget, too, a lot of the people who lived through that whole era under the communist regimes, they were Orthodox Christian, Eastern Orthodox, a lot of them. And because I'm in touch with some today, and they kept their own little secret services, private services going, you might say, for religious things in their own homes. Every town... It's very much like total information awareness network we have across the West now. In fact, they copied a lot of that from the Soviet system. So these folk who lived in Bulgaria and elsewhere, Czechoslovakia, had these private little meetings to celebrate their particular religion, because in every town and village there were private snoops working for the secret services that would shop them. The only difference was most of the folk in Bulgarian villages knew who the particular one was in their village, so they'd watch him as much as he watched them. So they could do these little things. But along with it came their morality. They carried that natural old morality along with them to help each other out. And that's so vitally important. We forget that because we're not given that side of the story. When things were terrible there starvation came along every so often in the Soviet systems, often on purpose. We saw them starving out Hungary, places like that. 6 or 7 million people died on the deliberate policy of starving the people out. As Stalin sold the grain abroad at that time. We forget that's been done across the whole Soviet system, including China. Mao Zedong did the same thing there. Deliberate policy. And folk that survived often survived because they still had something that kept them bonded together. In other words, a common culture. We forget, too, most common cultures have some form of religion, no matter what nation or type it is. They have something that holds them together and keeps their humanity intact so they can survive. In the West, we've lost all of that until it's dog-eat-dog. In fact, in the West, the guy who gets to the top by any means possible, no matter how vicious he's been, he's lauded and approved by the general population right down to the bottom level. They treat them like the kings because they've got so wealthy. That's what the West worships, is wealth. You know, that's what they worship. And you might say the religion in the West, especially in the US, is actually politics.
Thank you. arsenal while they're going through it. If you notice, most people today they're in la-la land. They have the glazed eyes. They have no interest.
There's a fantasy world out there.
Yeah, something's happened to their brain.
When was it that on one of the news, there was a serial show, situation comedy, where a woman was having was getting pregnant or something, and I think one of the vice president candidates or something was criticizing that TV personality, that character on television. And he came in for a scathing attack by the public. But it was just a TV personality. It wasn't a real person.
Well, the thing is, you know...
This is how crazy it's gotten.
There was a series on television, I think it was called Cheers, where it all took place in this bar where everyone knew each other.
Right.
One of the most popular shows, because everyone would love that type of community, where they have friends and people they know, and can go and meet every night. See, we don't have that in our lives anymore. We're isolated, we're stuck in our own rooms without television. You don't even know your neighbors. So they've broken not only the male-female family into dysfunctional units, they've broken the whole of society down, and now you're dictated through the television.
Did the neighborhood pubs in England act as that, as some means to get out of the house and meet some of your neighbors?
That's where all...
Before television?
That mattered. Yeah, all, even during television when it came in.
Yeah.
That's where everyone met to discuss social policies and things that affected them, and that the British government mandated that to the big chains of pubs to start putting televisions in the pubs.
Yeah, we got to have TV in the pubs.
And
right?
Sports, and then you couldn't hear yourself talk anymore.
There's so many distractions, and they're all self-pleasing and gratifying, right?
That's right.
I have a question. When you look back on ancient history, what do you depend on as being authentic, coming from the human spirit rather than the dictates of the powers that have been and are, for example, Christian Gnostics, Egyptian, the Book of the Dead, you know, all these things back? Do you think that they're all constructed, or what legitimately sprung from the human, you know, artistic endeavors and all this?
There's truth in all of them. Most religions were given for the public to obey the forms of government they had, but there's truth in there to do with human striving of spirit to reach the ultimate of being a complete human being, not turning into some kind of strange android or robot.
Now we're back to the independence thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, you get back into... Well, I'll say this about you, Alan. You're a unique individual.
Thank you.
And I think that's the greatest compliment I can give to you, because you really understand what I'm saying when I say that.
I appreciate it,
I think.
We'd love to have you back again sometime, Alan, if you don't mind, sometime
it's
in the future.
A pleasure. Yeah.
This conversation was so easy, and it flowed so well, and we hit on so many important things, points and so forth. And I really appreciate the time that you spent with us these 2 hours.
Yeah, we can go deeper next time.
Yes, let's do that. Let's do that. Alan Watt, thank you very much for enlightening other people and bringing them out of the darkness.
Iti flivame paradisco. I thought you were suggesting earlier that, you know, in the physical and material plane, that that maybe it implied that all physical existence was inherently evil. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not quite stating that quite right, but that's been one of the I think fallacies. Now, the Presbyterians, as characterized by, I guess, Calvin's tulip doctrine, with a T being total depravity, held that all creation was depraved or fallen and affected by the sin nature, including, you might say, inanimate objects, mm-hmm. were also part of the fall.
Yeah, the fall is the fall into matter. That's what it means. You fall into the world of matter, where there are fixed laws in matter. And it's true enough, you either eat or you work or you die. That kind of thing. The problem is they become so engrossed in the world of matter, and it'd be much easier if I dominate all of you and then you keep me in a good lifestyle, then I don't have to worry about all those fears anymore. And that's the problem, you see, with the world of matter. That's how the elite arise, and they're able to dominate everyone else by generally using a money system. The ancient people, remember, had no money of any kind, and they lived in a tribal type setting where everyone in the tribe was important to the tribe, regardless of your fitness physically or anything else. No one was left out of the tribe, and money really was the corrupting factor that allowed an elite to get a leisure class that could study and study over time and then become basically a priesthood that could then dominate you, the only learned class. So money was the key. Without money, you couldn't have had this leisured class that could sit and plan a future for the rest of the people. And the temptation in the world of matter is to become pragmatic, to do that which is practical, until you throw out anything which is of a humanitarian nature. And so you have an aberrant type creature, and that is the psychopath. The psychopath can rationalize any evil act against other people to please his own ego. They have no problems with that. They have no conscience. It's difficult for ordinary people to understand someone existing like that, but there are many of them who live and exist like that today.
This next very short arrangement that we'll play is also based on memories that I have going around the country. In December, you know, it's very cold. And if you play a brass instrument, the last thing you want to do is be outside playing. But the Salvation Army brass players play all over the country, all over the world, in the cold. And my heart always goes out for them when I see them doing this. And I've written this arrangement to be played the way they play it. Maybe not always perfect because they're freezing, but with a lot of soul and warmth.
And don't waste your time trying to make people wake up
when they've chosen, you see, they've chosen to stay in this cotton wool world of what they think is security. Being good, I'm being good, I'm doing what I'm told. I'm a good person, I'm a good citizen, I'm an authorized, stamped and approved person by the government. That's a choice, you see. That's a happy slave who's happy with the illusion that's been given to him. The illusion that, yep, for all his needs or crises in life, there's an agency out there that's going to help him. Leave him alone. He'll turn on you for bursting his bubble. That's a choice. At the end of ages, this happens, they say. People choose. The first tendency is to try and wake up those you love, you see. Those nearest to you. Which doesn't work, generally. Because the odds of finding someone in your own family who can wake up are so incredibly small. In the old esoteric traditions, they used to say that two would wake up in a bed, one would be gone suddenly, another left. Or in a field, one's gone, one's left. That's what they meant by that. It's coming into consciousness. When you come into consciousness, you leave the old world behind. That's what it always really meant. And this is the end of an age carefully prepared and run for such a long time by this dominant minority. They go by the cosmic clock. They use the zodiac, not for shuffling cards, not for the exoteric stories, but as a time clock for their agenda. As George Bush Sr. said with his New World Order speech, remember? He said, it's all going to the heavenly plan. That's what he meant by that, the time clock. In ancient times, the priests, for thousands of years, many thousands of years, much older than we're told, studied the stars and the movements, and they charted them. They charted the sun and the moon. The sun, moon, and stars. Huge cosmic time clocks. And they wrote their stories in with the exoteric covering for what they called the profane, those in the darkness, those not in understanding. It's still going on. The great zodiac, the circle, is also called the Platonic year or circle, the great circle. Many thousands of years long. Each one an age. If you go into Hindu religion, it's even much, much longer. Many ages, comprising millions of years. Most of what the West has been given has been cut out of the books. Because life did not begin with civilization at Sumer. Sumer was only one branch taking up again an old system that pre-existed. We are living in a time of choosing. It's a time when all of the material doesn't give us the joy we thought it would. Albeit temporary joy to begin with, because everything in the material world is temporary. It doesn't mean you live in misery. You're not supposed to live in misery in this world. The material world and the resources have been owned by a few for an awful long time. Yet even with the availability of credit cards and cheap mass-produced, I hesitate to call them goods, from China, people are finding out that there are big holes in their lives, big things missing, and they're hunting all over for answers in a time of crisis as the world prepares for the final big change for the end of this particular age. As I say, an age written about by those in the know for a few hundred years at least, more openly than before. We know where they're going to take the world through science, this cold-blooded type of inhumane system they wish to bring in, where they'll eradicate the ability to have even an emotion, which is obviously not very efficient. You see, they don't like inefficiency, and emotions are not efficient. They're human traits. They've got to take that which was left imperfect and perfect it in their own image, and that's the scientific way. It's a time of choice. It's a time when people have to start communicating quickly while they have the ability to do so. It's a time for those people in all lands, while they have the ability to communicate with each other, to do so. To communicate with people in other lands. And you'll find you have friends all over the world if you're honest with yourself and you're honest to them. Thank you.
dire Savior's birth. Long lay the worthiness in and error binding, if in a parent is all a flat is birth. A freedom
the same players that were attended at the Johns Hopkins rehearsal, you might say, dress rehearsal, they said they would attack folk eventually, they wouldn't shut up and were trying to say something else to the general public. They went through the scenarios of even having false news out there 2 years before it happened. All prepared for it. Here's how we treat them all. And then they'll block off your money, your income. Then they'll block off your ability to talk to the public, silence you. And you've seen it all happen to lots of people. I get the same thing. I've had the same thing here for years before the pandemic. But that's what happens. You don't live in a free society at all, you know. You'll be left alone if you're just watching pornography and stuff that they want you to watch and do and do things what they want you to do. Come on, no problem. You're safe then. I can remember, again, years ago, an old preacher in the States, and he used to come out. He's got a character, you know. Very few characters amongst them. They're all rather like peas in a pod, but he was a real character. And he said, you know, he says, Satan will leave you alone. He says, if you're just one of the crowd and doing, you know, like everybody else. He says, only when you start to see there's something really evil with the system that you'll start to get problems. That's pretty well how it is, isn't it? You're left alone if you're one of his own, as they say. But if you're trying to break away, then now you're a target because you're beginning to see, you know. You're beginning to see. As I said before, too, that, and I mentioned it last Wednesday doing that talk, that eventually I put up myself for the RA Central. But the absolute comparison of a psychopath with demonology, and I have no problems talking about demonology. I don't care who poo-poos it. It's like everything else. You can poo-poo everything unless you've maybe experienced it. At kind of close range at times. So who cares who poo-poos it and wants it to be scientific? Look at the incredible deception you're under right now with science. You're going to parrot that all day long, eh? All they said, COVID's real, we're all going to die if you don't take a shot, you know? And you watch cops beating up folk and strangling folk because they won't put a mask on. And some, I'll put some of these clips up too at cuttingthroughthematrix.com, quite a few little clips. I don't use YouTube too much. I can't get any speed because I'm getting so heavily choked, but I get little bits sent to me and so on. So I'll put them up. And even one from a doctor, another doctor woman who's pretty good. She's straightforward in what she's talking about. I think her name is Majez, but I'll put her up, one up as well. But I have no problem talking about demonology. And I mentioned that Malachi Martin was one example. And it's so paradoxical, really, isn't it? How at one point he definitely was paid, and he was paid by a group inside the US to really build up ammunition for an enemy of Vatican II who wanted to use it for their own agenda. And he was in the payroll, and he wrote something about, under different names, Brother Seraph, and he published a book and hit his own church, and it was used against the church, and the church never recovered. I don't see the church was ever perfect. The church, like every system, became corrupt long ago. Doesn't mean it all became corrupt, but we know for even during the communist years in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, during the American un-American Activities Commissions that they had, they found a woman, I remember talking about her years ago, and she admitted that her job as a communist organizer was also a selector. She selected people for different projects inside America. They put them into politics, naturally, but they also had other ones to go into the priesthood. And she was picking particular ones of certain persuasions to go into the priesthood. And that did come out, by the way. This is not happenstance or hearsay. This is you can actually look it up and read the actual inquiries about it at the time. And she put hundreds of people into the priesthood. They shouldn't have been there. They end up having their cabals. They're still affecting the reputation of the Catholic Church to this day. They're really, you know. But again, Malachi Martin, as I say, he also talked about the CIA. You can see an old documentary by when he was on as a guest, being interviewed by William Buckley Jr. Now, William Buckley Jr., it was admitted after he died, that he was also in the CIA, like many folk in the media. But in the actual interview, Malachi Martin talked about the CIA being awfully... He talked about the same thing when he was on the Art Bell show, that the CIA used lots of priests as intelligence sources because they were across the whole planet into countries that were also communist and enemies and so on. So I'm pretty sure Malachi Martin was well involved in that too. So he's a guy who eventually, as a Jesuit, ends up doing what many Jesuits have done, which was damage the church. And in one big way, ends up writing books about possession and demons and demonology. Awfully good book to read, by the way, even if it's just psychology they're into, you can certainly get a lot from it. but you can get Hostage to the Devil. Awfully good graphic observations, interpretations of mental states at the very, very least, right, and behavior, which can all, of course, psychiatrists have put down as mental illness to the bitter end. It wouldn't make it matter what happened. It'd be the bitter end. It'd be mental illness of some kind or another. And but you the other side of it too. It's a derangement by other forces. But when you put them down side by side, the possession, like perfect possession, is one category of possession, which is where a person is completely at home with the spirit or entity that's within, is in them. They're content and they can work well together. The problems in standard classical demonology is where a person fights, is still fighting, and they're not completely taken over by the entity that's in them. And there's a bit of resistance still there. Their indefinite anxiety all the time, maybe erratic behavior of all kinds in the process too, often similar to the old bipolar or manic depressive disorders as well. That's very similar sometimes, but odd behaviors always, you see. But when a person has deliberately taken an entity on board and sorted out, it's a different kettle of fish. And when you have an elite, not all of them, I mean, who knows, but if you have an elite group that literally, maybe intergenerationally, have taken these things on board, definitely they put out suggestions that some of the organizations they're into through the last century and a half, in occultic sort of sense with it, or even in the last couple of hundred years, in fact, or more, some branches, especially French Freemasonry, they had some branches within there, and in London, of course, with the Hellfire Club. You definitely had this idea of eugenics, number one, of selective breeding, special breeding, mating for different purposes than just being horny, put it that way. But to actually create a type of a child. You find it going way, way back even to John Dee and the magical child that was eventually repeated and repeated all the way up to Crowley. So you're looking at something a bit different from that, from the usual horror movie interpretation of it. So eugenics is definitely involved in it to an extent. When the Hellfire Club, like some of the top Masonic groups in Britain, had brothels attached to them. Not any old brothel, it was just for certain members. And some of them were selected because, and they're called dollies. The dolly is a carrier. A dolly, just like the anything that you push to carry luggage on, is a carrier. They carried the genes, particular genes of higher families and so on. And part of the upper admission into some of the, and I'm not making this stuff up, this is from their old books and so on, was that you would be given permission to mate with a particular one until she was pregnant, and then she would have an offspring, you see. And from one of these dollies, the carriers of the right kind of genes, you know. And I could go on about that because it's an interesting field of eugenics. And we also know, too, that Charles Darwin was the offspring between the Darwin family and the Wedgwood family, because they've been doing it already for a few generations, and after him, too, still doing it. Just intermarrying with the same one family for special genetic breeding of what they claim was the better traits, make them special. That continued right up into the 20th century, and I'm sure it still happens today with certain groups of them. And that's documented. It's not conspiracy at all. It's just documented history. And when he's, I think when he's... When his wife died, I think he married it was his mother's sister or something. It was something. It was really real inbreeding for sure, and it's often thought that's part of the problem with the Darwins,
because they end up having tremendous headaches as it's hereditary. And then when they cross-matched into the Huxley family as well later on, which they did, and intermarry eventually that way, a lot of them had tremendous headaches and they were bedridden with and depressions, you know. So these were hereditary traits that would be passed on, you see, more so with inbreeding. So yeah, you have that. But now, supposing you go another level, though, when you want to bring in the spirit, just like the ancient Egyptians talked about too, the opening of the mouth ceremony and so on, where you could they believed that it was a strange way of looking at things. It wasn't just reincarnation; it was transmigration of souls, where if a father died, the pharaoh, and the son was nowhere near, he was off in a different province, maybe examining the province or something like that, or on some business, then they couldn't just have, there had to be a proximity factor to transfer the spirit to the pharaoh. One of the parts, they had about a five-part soul, you see, one of the main parts, to put it into the son. And so they would go through a ceremony, an elaborate ceremony, where they would say that they could store it in the mouth, you see, the opening the mouth ceremony, in a statue, and then do the same thing, and then transfer it to the son when he got home, like a safe, put in a safe for a little while. And that is a very elaborate ceremony, but all these kind of, it was very important to them anyway, because they had so many different parts of spirit and soul in Egypt. But that became kind of pop. This idea really fascinated people in the 1800s, and they got into it, some of the different occultic groups. And we know too that Yeats and different people were heavily involved in the occult in their time as well. And much of the poetry, in fact, was put out was actually ceremonies, for those who don't know it. You know, it's quite interesting when you can actually understand what they're about. But anyway, the idea was to bring something more important than you into your body. That's what Aleister Crowley was in. And he had a big following, remember? And lots of aristocracy were involved in it at that level too. And the artistic community, as usual, as well, were involved in it. It didn't quite die off. And then they had a revival in the late 1800s with Theosophy that tried to bring more and more and more of it and blend it with India. But there's almost that element of the higher groups that go through elaborate ceremonies, even today, to bring a higher entity into some people. Remember, there's branches of Masonry that are pretty well atheistic as well. Remember that as well. Yeah? But for the occultic groups, there are certain ones went all the way, often as an excuse perhaps for free sex as well and all the rest of it. But some of them still believed that there was a higher, that these were entities of superior beings they could bring into themselves, or people who had lived long, long before them. And some of the groups saw these entities as gods, ancient gods, you see. And it wasn't a unique idea at all. It flourished in ancient times in the Middle East, and even in ancient Hebrew. Into Judaism, early Judaism too, they had this idea, a different view on good and bad, right and wrong, as they have today. It's different again, different changes. But when Judaism took on Kabbalism and really pushed it, the early ones saw these entities that could be used. Today, in Christianity, you look upon things as demons. But in Judaism, there were entities that you could call down if you knew their names. Again, it's very Egyptian in a way as well, or taken from Egypt and other areas around that area, even previous to Egypt, in fact, I'm sure. Many, many thousands of years old, these ideas proliferated and were copied by different cultures down through time. But the idea was that especially when you worship people as gods, like pharaohs, and it was unthinkable often for the people to believe that the pharaoh's body died, so therefore what was in him, this powerful being inside him, the spirit, was dead too. So they would say that they would think it went on, as it could even be transferred to the son of the Pharaoh. And therefore they were looked upon as gods, immortal gods. Even if the one body died, they'd have another one to enter into. So you're into the same area as demonology. And as I say, John Dee was really into this. He learned the Kabbalah and Hebrew. He was a real devotee. And the idea was to call down these entities and use them. And not to be afraid of them, you see. With the idea that you could do that. If you knew the right, almost code words, like passwords, like computers, you could make them do your bidding. That was the idea. That's the idea behind all magic. And, of course, Aleister Crowley took the same idea that he didn't invent and pushed it too into more real practice, physical practice, into his little society they had around him. And that's continued up until they had a big explosion again with the New Age, as they call it, New Age, in the 1960s onwards with the hippies. They introduced all this stuff again. And again, the theosophy idea of blending spirit with science, which Blavatsky boasted about, that was their goal. Odd thing to say, isn't it? And it struck me when I was looking at the World Trade Organization and the World Economic Forum. They're all the same members, by the way, that run all these things. And again, reimagining humanity. And in it, of course, they have the whole idea of life extension, which they do have today. They've had it for quite a while. But I remember watching a little clip that someone sent me, and it was from Israel. And it was someone, it was a scientist, a well-known scientist over there, in a general talk. And there's a lot of people coming into the room as he started his talk, and they were kind of yapping away as the man was trying to speak. But he said quite casually there, he says, of course, you know that if you've got a spare $7 million that you to spend, he says, we can keep you alive till you're 140 today. That's what he said. So nonchalantly, too. You know? No, he didn't elaborate and say it's with just lots of transplants and so on. It would entail a lot more than that, I'm sure. But it can be done. And I remember years ago, too, I think it was David Suzuki mentioned it, too, in one of his TV talks when he was on about the same guy who compared humanity's levels of parasites or really living off the dung of the ones above them. That's why we said it to his students. Eh? The dropping of the ones above them as we classified society. You know, he mentioned, too, that at one time that they could pretty well stop the time gene, the clock, and the gene, the genetic structure, and telomeres and so on, at that time, that was years ago, if they wanted to. And I'm sure many folk have had it. We know that old man Rockefeller died when he died there a few years ago. I think he was 103. That he was still giving talks and traveling the world up until the end. You know, he didn't seem to have the old age illnesses like arthritis or stone deaf or blind or whatever. And he was able to stand and give his talks. I think it did come out. He'd had a few heart transplants, maybe three of them or four, who knows. But I'm sure there are a lot more to it than that, because they don't come down, if you notice, with senility either. Eh? Their arteries are cleaned out, clean, and the blood flow is good, etc. Anyway, that's a whole different parcel of an area to itself. But the thing is, this drive for immortality, and don't think I'm getting off the topic with demonology, the drive for immortality, as I mentioned on that last Wednesday's show, Neil Foster and Reality Bites Radio, was that a demon is a bodiless entity. It can't experience anything unless it's inside a physical body. And then you have a whole range of senses that come into play in a physical body. That's heaven to a demon, you see. Otherwise, it's like an enclosed off. It's like something floating in the blankness of space, and it's living in its own mind. But if you put a demon into a body, then suddenly all this the wonders of sensation an experience comes into play. And therefore they don't want to leave it, you see. Or if they leave it, or if they've killed it, if the host is fighting and they kill it, then they want to move into another one immediately. So heaven to a demon is the physical world. For people who live in the physical world, their heaven is away from the physical world. It's the opposite, which is interesting to me in a way. It's like we have Jesus say in the New Testament, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. Yeah. So a whole religion is based on a different world for a spirit to go to, you see. But a demon wants the opposite. It comes from another world, another realm, and wants to exist permanently here. Well, look at the elite and look at their drive. Using all your tax money for experimentation for the last couple of hundred years, at least, big time, for life extension for themselves, right down to possible, not just even creating clones for each other. That's been a big drive for a long time. Oh my God, they said in the 90s, we could probably create clones for ourselves and just keep them for body parts. This is how they explained it to the public. They had big pushes on this, by the way, and don't think for that they had never done it. They don't go by the laws they give for you, you know. They have authorized institutions for themselves way above all of this. And then you had movies like The Island to do with them, even cloning body parts, getting, you know, I'm sure they're a good chuckle at all that kind of thing. And not to be confused with the there's other old movies called The Island. It's a different thing. That was from Dr. Moreau's Island, you know, an old idea of experimentation. I think it was H.G. Wells did it too. They owned Dr. Moreau. So anyway, a demon wants to live forever in this world. You look at the elite and the drive they have to live permanently and stop the time clock in this world. They've had so many articles out and their books as well, not just magazines, and for general television and so on. So many articles about that very thing, that it'd be wonderful for them to live forever and just stop the time gene, maybe at the age of 25 or something, you know. So you'd be the peak of health and you'd never age. You would never come down with old age illnesses. Your eyes and your eyesight should be as good at the age of 500 as it was when you actually hit 25 and they stopped the time clock. You know, what you're looking at is what a demon would want: to live forever in the physical world, isn't it? That is its heaven. So you can toss things around all you want, and I don't mind tossing all these ideas around my head. I have no problem with them at all. I have no problem with folk who ridicule it either. I say, oh, he's a fanatic or a nutcase. I don't care what folk think about it. It's something you think about, isn't it? When you see the similarities, as I said before, things quiet like a duck and walk like a duck, it's generally a duck. So regardless of how you want to define it, it is the same process that something is after for the same reasons, isn't it? Psychopathic, mental illness, demonology is so similar, isn't it? And so I wouldn't poo-poo things that easily if I were you. I really can't imagine the people who formed the Bolshevik slaughter teams that are well documented by themselves and by the orders put out by Lenin to these groups as being basically just pure. If that's what human is, you understand we're done for. If humans are the cold-blooded humanistic types of psychopaths, call it that, yeah, that are atheistic, they have no problems, God is dead, therefore everything that was impossible is now possible. If that's what humans are, we're in big trouble. And the more you start to believe that is their sciences, you know, that is the sciences, humanism is the new religion, it's a good thing, you better say, God help us, because nothing else will, because you'll go along with their terrible plans. I really mean that. The Bolsheviks, as I've said, were given instructions, just like Antifa right at the moment. You're actually seeing very carefully constructed Bolshevik techniques being used right now by design. It's not by accident. And Lenin said, he said, to get the little farmers all on board here, to terrify them into submission and to give up all their crops and all their rights and their property and their religion and to accept us as the dominant force of government. It says, just go into little towns and villages, pick people who have more say or who are looked up to. They don't have to be wealthier even than the average peasant. Just pick them, a few of them, maybe five per village or more, and horribly execute them. And order that everybody must attend their execution. And what they did, they cut the intestines, the small intestines, at the lower part where it touched the large intestine, and brought it out of the abdomen. They would tie them to posts in town and make the person walk round and round and round as it unraveled. And this is the truth, folks. I know it's unpleasant, but you understand something. Horror always repeats itself unless you're willing to look at horror in the face. Otherwise, you're not going to stop it happening again. And that's how they watched them until the people just fell down dead in horrible, terrible pain and horrible. And believe you me, that technique had everybody on their knees to communism very quickly. Horrible, isn't it? This isn't made up. This is, you can find the old writings, disclosed stuff from the old communist archives too, in the Soviet Union. And that's where humanism will get you, because there's nothing else to elevate humanity as something special. And regardless of what religion you're looking at, religion always appealed, especially to young people. When you're willing, you're not jaded with the drudgery or the nastiness of everyday life by those who rule you. It wears you down. And you're optimistic, perhaps, because you're young and you feel great and you're healthy, you hope. But you do know that there's something beyond all of this. Every child goes through it, I think. Almost every child goes through it. They used to. Where they look into areas that were looked down upon by the general religions. But they would at least look into them and see, what if, and maybe it could be, and blah, blah, blah. And you just know, because your intuition, it isn't just intuition at that stage. There's another element where you'd sit with your buddies, you know, and you'd start singing the same line of a song at this precise moment that a person would start singing, out of the blue. Hadn't thought about it all day, it would just come out, things like that. Then you look at each other and laugh. That's so common when you're young. You're unfortunately with this system, it's knocked out of you so quickly by the system. Because it's a clue there's something else beyond the basic 2 and 2 equals 4 here. There's another element to it. And it's the same element that would guide you in to deeper truths, to do with a belief system that accepts something called the supernatural. And it's the supernatural that accepted and gave you rights as a human being. A human being wasn't something that would just be slaughtered because you were in the way of progress, like it is in an atheistic society. You understand? And humanism, there's no reason why an authority shouldn't eliminate you if you're in the way of anything. There's no morality there. Morality comes from your acceptance of something bigger than yourself. And if you accept something bigger than yourself, that you are aware of, then you're aware that other that this bigger thing gives the rights to other people as well, other humans as well. It's part of the affinity you have as a human being for others. Don't forget Julian Huxley. You should read what he wrote about for UNESCO in his speeches too. He mentioned them. What he talked about society and how he says we will have to knock humanity off its pedestal as being a superior species on the planet with all of its rights in order to dominate and change society and guide it. Who's the we he's talking about here? Huh? This is the same guy that was a co-founder of Planned Parenthood. But we shall have to do it. We have, knock us off. Well, once you're knocked off and they tell you and convince you through the countless TV programs, eh, with the furry animals, that you're just another furry animal. Maybe furry, if you're not bald. But, yeah. And once you start to believe it.
Love one another as I've done unto you, do unto others. Oh yeah. The teacher said, show me your friend, and he'll show me the man I am. Spending life discerning wrong from right. My Lord loved the homeless souls. Who are we to shut our doors on anyone who wants to see the light? He says, love one another. Love your sister. Love your brother. Love one another as I've done unto you, do unto others. Love is gentle, love is kind, strong enough to blow your mind, tougher than a pit bull on a bone. Love can break a hardened heart or mend the one that's torn apart. The smartest thing you have ever known. So, love one another. Love your sister. Love your brother. Another, as I've done unto you, do unto others. Oh my Lord, he is no color. He's a father. He's a mother. He's a sister. And he's a brother. He's the love we'll share for one another. Oh, one another.